have you call your next witness for the petitioners, Dr. Kinsborn. There is an issue I'd like to address. In your opening remarks, Mr. Powers, you raised anew the issue of the UK litigation. Then, of course, that came up in the course of Dr. Kennedy's testimony. Based on my recollection, some 5 months ago, we invited petitioners to make application to the UK, as their law apparently permits private parties to do, to seek release of whatever data it was that you thought you needed in this case. Have you done so? Or do you contemplate doing so?
We made inquiries to legal counsel, and legal counsel informed us that at that point we could not get release of those documents. It's not a confidence that's held by the party that submitted the information.
Right.
But we are actively investigating and are working up what we need to do in order to make an, and I don't know if it's called make, I honestly just don't know. I mean, yeah. I just talk to the people that know that, and I'm told that we're doing what we can to pursue getting the release of those documents, but it's not something where an individual person can say, I waive any confidentiality or I waive the applicability of an order as to my material.
Well, at least in terms of what the government told us in the course of the lead up to the Cedillo hearings, it did not take them 5 months to do so. Number one. And number two, it apparently securing the permission of the individuals whose data or whose reports were being released was a factor that persuaded or helped persuade the UK judge in that matter. I'm concerned that we're now 5 months down the road. We're finishing the last of the first theory cases, even with the post-trial briefing schedule, if you're going to submit more evidence that may necessitate some additional evidence by the government, that we are running out of time.
Understood, Special Master.
So on my behalf, if not that of my colleagues, I urge you to do so with speed and diligence.
Understood.
Okay.
Special Master, on that last point.
Yes.
Just so that it's clear, we did want, the government was trying to get...
I understood you were trying to get the whole thing.
Yes, and so we would be supportive of efforts to try to secure that information.
I just felt that it was necessary to make those issues clear on this record, given the posture of this litigation.
I completely understand both the rationale for putting it on the record and, more importantly, I think the substance of your remarks.
And
I will take Mr. Mananosky's comments to heart, too, because if we can more actively pursue this, that would, I think, be very fruitful.
Again,
to the parties, but really it's about giving information to you all to make the best decision you can on the evidence.
I know that on behalf of my colleagues and myself that we would like to have the most complete record possible. No, we are cognizant that we are not only deciding one case, but that we are developing a record that will help us decide 5,000 other cases.
Right.
And we would like to make not just the correct decision on the record before us, but the correct decision.
Absolutely. And I'm happy to work with Respondents' Counsel to see if we might even be able to pursue that together in some way.
And just in case it's not clear, there was some discussion with Dr. Kennedy about Dr. Oldstone. Dr. Oldstone, any information about Dr. Oldstone that he was exchanging with Dr. O'Leary was not part of the litigation.
Right.
Those efforts were not, so that's not privileged in any way.
Yeah, we understand that. And that's just a practical matter of that letter coming in when it did, then injecting a specific issue around a specific person with specific statements in an interchange. That means we need to go out and develop the evidence we can, which we will do very quickly. Because I entirely agree, that's not privileged, it's not confidential, it's not in the UK. I have already developed a pretty good idea of where it is, what it looks like, and who has it, and we'll develop that as quickly as we can.
Wonderful. All right. With that, are you prepared to call your next witness?
We certainly are, Special Master. The petitioners in this case would like to call Dr. Marcel Kinsborn,
who has come come prepared with this water bottle. It is.
And for Dr. Kinsborn, it's much easier to get into the building with a bottle of water than with a computer. So we will not be using computer displays here today, and I'll let him.
Would you raise your right hand, Dr. Kinsborn? Do you swear or affirm that the evidence you shall give in the case now in hearing should be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth? So help you God.
I do.
Thank you. Please be seated.
Good afternoon, Dr. Kinsborn.
Hello.
So that we have a good record here with the court reporter, if you could go ahead and state and spell your name and give us your academic or professional affiliation, if you would.
Yes. Marcel, M-A-R-C-E-L, Kinsborn, K-I-N-S-B-O-U-R-N-E, off the record, am I echoing too much? Oh, good. My address is 158 Cambridge Street, Winchester, Massachusetts, and I'm a professor at the New School in New York.
Now, Dr. Kinsborn, I know that you were here earlier today when Dr. Ron Kennedy testified, and as a preliminary matter, I want to cover some of the same issues with you that I did with Dr. Kennedy so that we make a clear record for the proceedings in this case. In the Savio matter, which was the first of three designated test cases brought on behalf of the petitioner steering committee, you testified in the Savio matter back in June of 2007, is that correct?
That is correct.
And your testimony, as I understand it, included the submission of an expert report, the presentation of direct oral testimony, cross-examination, is that right?
That's correct.
Now, my understanding is that there's no supplemental report or rebuttal report that you've prepared or have in the works anticipating to file in the Cedillo matter. Is that right?
That's also true, yes.
In your appearance here today, as was the case in the Cedillo matter, my understanding, and I want to make sure that it's your understanding also, is that you're here, in a sense, wearing two hats. The first hat is that you're offering testimony on issues of general causation that might apply to other cases in the omnibus proceeding. Is that a correct understanding?
Yes, sir.
And then secondarily, I shouldn't say secondarily, but just the other hat, because they're both equally important. The other hat is that you're offering expert testimony to be used in the resolution of the individual claim here, Colton Snyder's claim for compensation.
Yes.
And that was the case in the Cedillo matter. You were offering individual case testimony in that matter.
Correct.
You're appearing today and offering a report and your testimony. The idea is that everything in the Cedillo matter from the petitioner's side, we are treating that as on file and available to the parties and the special masters in this proceeding so that we don't have to repeat all the evidence and all the testimony. Is that your understanding?
Yes.
So in your report today and your testimony today, I am assuming that there are moments or points where you will not go into detail that has already been covered in Cedillo in order to avoid redundancy, right?
Yes, indeed.
But by avoiding redundancy, it's not to be construed as somehow waiving an argument or unmaking a point that you made before, correct?
Absolutely.
Okay. Just wanted to establish that for the record, and I'll pause now because I anticipate that respondent may have if there's an objection to make to doing that, as they did earlier. Okay. Now, Dr. Kinsborn, I already discussed that you were here earlier today and heard Dr. Kennedy, but you were here yesterday morning when the parties presented opening statements. Is that right?
Yes, I was.
And you recall in Mr. Johnson's opening statement a mention of Andy Wakefield's work. Do you recall that reference?
I do.
And you recall a reference to 10 years of time since Dr. Wakefield proposed a hypothesis and began an area of inquiry, but in the intervening 10 years, that theory has been, I think the word was, debunked.
I remember that.
My understanding is that you have some comments to make about the idea that Dr. Wakefield's theory has been debunked, and that those comments would be relevant to proving the case here. If you could go ahead and share with the special master your thoughts on that issue.
Thank you. Apart from the fact that the rhetoric of debunked has no place in discussions of medical science, putting that aside, I would like to make a distinction between Dr. Wakefield's specific theory of causation as offered at the time being around the end of the 90s, 1998 or so, and the way that the science of autism has moved in the intervening period. The fact being that the science of autism has, if I may coin a phrase, surged tremendously since about that time. How much that has to do with Dr. Wakefield's comment, I'm not sure about, but I bet some of it has to do with it. At any rate, there are a number of areas in which perspective of medical scientists working in autism have been transforming. The first and most sweeping one is a change from considering autism as a static deficit, presumably of early origin, to considering it as an ongoing disease happening every moment of the individual's life with autism. Now, the background of autism theories is, of course, that initially the approach was psychodynamic. Next, the approach became cognitive, that it was a language disorder that was thought for quite a while, and that the rest of the syndrome was a spin-off from the language difficulties. That was abandoned, and a strong feeling emerged that it was a genetic disorder of its own kind. And when I say it, I'm referring to that large, say 80 to 90% of autistic children who don't have syndromic autism, which is autism in association with other deficits due to identified genetic abnormalities or toxic abnormalities. Now, the idea that that autism is an ongoing disease is a very important one. It suggests different causations, and it suggests a quite a different approach to management. And both these options have been taken up by the science that ensued. In a way, the roadblock to taking a very active therapeutic approach to autism has been this genetic idea, with genetics having a sort of flavor of predestination. The child's genes aren't right, that's why he or she is the way they are. And until recently, nobody knew how to alter anything at that level of analysis. However, it's now increasingly realized that genetic does not exclude environmental, but rather that many genes predispose the individual to react in different anomalous or abnormal ways to particular environmental exposures, meaning that having a genetic predisposition is necessary but not sufficient for the development of autism in that particular case. But when the exposure occurs, which might be an exposure that for almost everybody else is innocuous, would be harmful to the child who has that genetic predisposition.
And Dr. Kinsmore, if I could interrupt for a second, you just mentioned that there's increasing scientific attention being paid to this issue of environmental and gene interaction. You're aware, I assume, that the Institutes of Medicine just this past year held a two-day meeting, and they discussed a wide variety of ways in which the gene and the genes and the environment can interact to produce autistic symptoms in children. Are you familiar with that?
I am indeed, and there are other manifestations. One is in the person of Samuel Latta, who's been long-standing well-known authority on autism, who previously took the language point of view that I mentioned, and now has written some excellent articles on the importance of gene-environment interaction in psychopathology. And there are other reputable scientists. I submitted to the court in severe matter articles by Dr. Martha Herbert at Harvard University representing their point of view, and the court is very familiar, I'm sure, with it.
And also even some of the federal agencies that are involved, in a sense, the client agencies here of the respondent, various bodies within the CDC, the NIEHS, a lot of those entities are involved in either participating directly or funding research into possible environmental contributing factors to autism. Isn't that correct?
That is true. It's also true that the Mind Institute at the University of California at Davis has an active program in these matters. The third point that where there's been, I think, a considerable change is that until recently it was assumed that autism is a brain disease. It is becoming more recognized that it is a disease which affects the brain. Among other organs, the other organs of note, of course, being the gastrointestinal system and the immune system. Now, the effect of these changes is to shift another assumption, and that is the assumption which was sort of tacitly present for a long time, that those children with non-syndromic autism, namely autism, 80 or 90% of them, basically your typical autistic child, they all suffer from a condition called autism. And now, most everybody concedes that there are clearly multiple causes of autism, and that's just taken for granted now. It's not even controversial. The one important effect of that to cases like Colton Snyder's is the view that's taken of those autistic children who regressed into autism after an initial period of normal or near normal development. Why do you think, if you think that there is a condition called autism, and you find that a certain percentage, say 20% or even more of children regress, well, that's one of the ways which autism presents, and you don't necessarily ask further questions. And in fact, regression into autism has been known for numerous decades. And curious enough, to my knowledge, had never been separately, specifically studied, as opposed to being included in larger studies of autism, of which, of course, have been very many. Once one considers that actually autism has multiple causes, and presumably multiple pathogenesis, then one can look at regression in a different light. Namely, as a progressive encephalopathy of unknown cause. The fact that the outcome is autism doesn't give you the cause, and it doesn't persuasively tell you that its cause is the same as the cause of autism in these other children. Maybe, may not be. So, I take the view, and people increasingly take the view, that a regressive autism should be studied in its own right, and on the face of it, something is happening to the child's brain at the time that the child is regressing. And it is not sufficient to say in a post hoc fashion, oh well, since autism is genetic, there must be something to do with the timing of the gene effects. Now that is a speculation. Unlike most everything we're discussing in this case, which is not a speculation, this is. No evidence whatever for it. So a pediatric neurologist particularly takes most seriously a state of affairs when a child loses intellectual capabilities. That's one of these most alarming situations, and in any other such case, other than in aggressive autism, these children are intensively investigated and get great attention, not always with much therapeutic effect, unfortunately.
And Dr. Kingsborn, again, to focus on Colton Snyder's case, is it your opinion that what Colton Snyder experienced was in fact a regression into autism at a certain point?
It clearly was, yes.
And I know you say it in your report, but I just want to make it clear, that's based on your review of Dr. Bradstreet's records and all of his medical records, correct?
Yes.
And that's based on your sitting through and hearing the testimony of family members and caregivers, is that correct?
Right. I don't see that as controversial.
Right. And so all of that goes into form your opinion that it's more likely than not, to a reasonable degree of medical probability, that Colton was neurotypical and then regressed into autism at some point.
I believe that's so.
Okay. Right.
So as a consequence of that particular perspective on aggressive autism, it will be my opinion that if one were to study it in any way, it should be studied in its own right, and that includes epidemiology. That I don't find epidemiology about autism in general informative about the issues with aggressive autism. And ultimately, in terms of the epidemiological approach to causation with respect to NMR, I would have thought the obvious study to do would be a case-controlled study in which one compares autistic children who have received NMR with autistic children who have not received NMR. And for all I know, that data is already available, but certainly hasn't been published.
And then even within that sort of a study, it sounds like it would be important to make distinctions in the outcomes, at least, between a broadly defined autism diagnosis and a regressive autism diagnosis. Is that fair to say?
I'm thinking specifically of regressive. I'm not even considering the other kind. That's still a lot of children. And as the court knows, the incidence of autism has enormously increased over the last 10, 15 years, and that includes the incidence of aggressive autism. And as a comment on that, it has been pointed out quite cogently that you can't necessarily assume that that increase of incidence is one-to-one in relation to an increase in the actual prevalence of the disorder, because there may be changes in classification, changes in ascertainment, more or less vigilance and knowledge about the condition. But I have to say that whereas it is clearly easy to be uncertain what's going on with a child with classical autism who slowly begins to develop in a not very typical trajectory and wonders, is he deaf? Have we as parents done the wrong thing, and so on, when a child loses skills that he or she had, I don't quite see how that could be overlooked. So I do think it's very likely that the real incidence of aggressive autism has been increasing. Obviously, I don't know why. I've already given the opinion that there are multiple causes, so any combination of those multiple causes might be responsible. I'm just drawing the court's attention to this particular point of view.
And another thing, Dr. Kinsmore, when you talk about multiple causes, I assume you're talking about multiple causes within a population, but also multiple causes in an individual. So when you say multiple causes, are you talking about in an individual you may have genetic predispositions and environmental exposure, so you have multiple causes for one person, as well as across a population?
Yes, I think that in a proportion of children with autism, there was in fact an interaction between a susceptibility and a triggering event, what some people would call a double hit. I have no position as to how many such children there are within the population. I just don't know whether it's a large number or a small or a whole number or a medium number. One more point of changing science, because these are enormous changes to my mind from how we looked at things even only 10 years ago, is that we were looking for a rather classical neuropsychological type of database. You were asking which areas have to be malfunctioning to generate those symptoms and those impairments. So one looks at one has looked at the hippocampus, the amygdala, and the cerebellum. These were the earliest areas incriminated. And there's nothing wrong with that. But there's now an increasing tendency to think not so much of static deficits or failures to develop in those particular areas as changes in the way the network is functioning. Broad changes of network interaction, and there have been a number of articles recently published, important ones, giving evidence for that to be the appropriate approach and making suggestions as to what these changes are. It so happens that one of the most important approaches is the one that I cited by submitting the article by Rubinstein and Mosenick, who talk about a change in the excitation inhibition ratio as accounting for autistic behaviors in at least some of these children, which is personally gratifying to me because I had argued decades ago that overactivation explained autistic symptomatology, and I have submitted to the court two of my articles to that effect. So, in all, there has been an enormous increase of interest in autism research, and to come back to my initial point, whereas Dr. Wakefield's specific proposition has not been firmly validated, the approach that he took is very much in tune with the way the science has been going since he first presented his ideas. It so happens that the specific mechanism of causation which Dr. Wakefield supported, namely a gut-brain interaction with an opioid overflow and opioid damage to the brain, has never been proven or disproven. It's still a possibility, but our knowledge has not, in that respect, much advanced. The theory that I'm proposing is a different theory from Dr. Wakefield's theory.
And we'll talk in some detail about the theory of what happens with the persistent measles virus when it gets into the brain. We'll get to that point eventually. But I want to fill in a few of the steps that get us from here to there, and particularly in the case of Colton Snyder. Now, you would agree, and again, this is just to avoid completely regurgitating the expert report that you filed and the testimony in Cedillo, but your conclusions here ultimately are based on the presence of a persistent replicating measles virus in Colton Snyder that got into his brain. Is that correct?
That is correct.
And the evidence that you have that that has occurred is the presence of the measles virus RNA and protein in the cerebrospinal fluid, indicating that it's in the brain. Is that correct?
Yes, sir.
In reaching the conclusion that the measles virus actually exists in the brain, as you describe in your report and your testimony, you are relying on the testimony in part of Dr. Kennedy, who we heard before, and all of the lab results and the academic work that supports his conclusion.
I am.
So really, if there's measles virus in the brain, as Dr. Kennedy has explained, and if the evidence is reliable, as he's explained, that gives you the basis for your opinion that the measles virus in the brain can then initiate a process that causes injury.
That is completely correct.
Okay. Now, one of the issues that's come up, and we've heard it in testimony and reports in Cedillo, and we haven't heard testimony from the respondents yet, but on cross-examination and in their reports, there is issue made of, in general, the presentation of symptoms we see in autism are not symptoms that are typically seen in other measles infectious cases. I'd like you to address, to the extent that you can, that argument and perhaps explain why you are able to make the leap between measles virus exposure and neurological injuries as you're describing them here.
Right. Was pointed out, and that is obvious, we do know at a scientific level of certainty of two disorders of the brain caused by the measles virus of delayed onset. And they are SSPE and MIBE. Now, one point of interest in both these disorders is that they demonstrate that the measles virus, in most cases the wild measles virus, can indeed persist in the body. In the case of SSPE, the interval of time between the initial measles infection and the first presentation of this deadly brain disease ranges between 8 and 30 years. And it is considered that the measles virus has been lurking in neurons all this time. In the case of MIBE, the period of time is more in terms of months than of years, but there has been a case report which I submitted to Cedillo, Pittman, in which it was verified in one such case that the virus that had caused the condition and the death was actually a vaccine type. Now, having delineated these two known ways for the measles virus to damage the brain, I cannot agree that we should therefore close the book and argue that, as it were, that's all the measles virus is allowed to do with regard to the brain. That we have exhausted the neurotopic and neuropathic potential of the measles virus. I mean, that's not true in any aspect of medical science. Actually, Dr. Kennedy happened to give a dramatic example this morning of how the same virus can cause either a spasticity in the nervous system or a leukemia. There is no reason to foreclose the possibility and sometimes the probability that the measles virus can in fact manifest neurologically in a third way, or for all I know, in a fourth way. I might mention, although I mentioned an article by Dr. Paul Dyken, which I have not filed, but now find maybe would be helpful to the court if I were to file it subsequently. Paul Dyken is a renowned expert on SSPE. He is in charge of the World Registry of SSPE, and he has written, and he was one of the colleagues who visited the British case, incidentally, and met him there. And he wrote an article in which he said, there's SSPE, and then there's this condition, which we're discussing here, which he has his own name for, which is an atypical response of the brain to the measles vaccine virus. He finds it not at all difficult to think of a neurological disorder caused by the measles virus, which is neither MIBE nor SSPE. So I don't see the strength of the argument for closing other possibilities.
And can you give examples that you're aware of measles virus causing neurological injuries, and in particular vaccine strain measles virus that causes injury?
Oh, yes. The more usual way for the measles vaccine virus to cause neurological injury is to do so within a week or so, rather than in a very delayed fashion. But when I say usual, that of course isn't really a good word to use, because we have to remember these are rare events. They're all rare events, and that makes a difference in terms of how we judge the plausibility of them occurring relative to surveys of common events, what happens commonly. But in fact, Dr. Kennedy mentioned the article by Weibel et al., which this was a group of investigators from the CDC who analyzed submissions to the VAERS program over a number of years, set up their criteria for validating the causation, and then described the pattern of pathology and the time intervals that they found. And they listed a number of neurological manifestations in various combinations of encephalopathy, convulsions, ataxia, and occasionally death, and the time frame, which was rather typically within the second week after onset. So as far as I can tell, this is well accepted. I haven't heard much argument about it. Yes, the measles vaccine virus on rare occasions can damage the brain.
Now, so you've talked about instances where the measles vaccine virus can damage the brain, and you've just discussed how the measles virus, although it can cause known diseases, that doesn't rule out the possibility of it causing other diseases. I want to move on and talk a little bit about viral persistence. Now, again, you were here earlier, and you heard Dr. Kennedy testify about the persistence of measles virus. Is that correct?
Yes.
During his testimony, he described not being able to provide a mechanism by which the measles virus persisted in the body. Do you recall that testimony?
I do.
Would you agree with Dr. Kennedy? Do you have a model or a mechanism of measles persistence that would either be different from or more expansive than his?
No, as a neurologist, I wouldn't be in a position to go into the cellular level of it. No doubt it persists in cells, and I know that it could persist in lymphoid tissue, and it could persist in other areas, but I can't be specific about it. What I can say in that connection is what I've actually already said in passing, which is that we know measles virus can persist substantially. It's one of those viruses that can persist for decades, actually. And although obviously the question of whether a measles vaccine virus persists like that is a controversial issue, or we wouldn't be here, it's not at all unreasonable to suppose that it can.
Right. And at some point, the presence of the measles virus in the cerebrospinal fluid in a child like Colton Snyder, talking about the proof being in the pudding, that's the proof that you would need, even absent a model, a mechanistic model, of how the persistence occurred. Is that correct?
Yes, indeed. To me, this is a dramatic and key finding, and I've said that before, and it has, you know, most important implications, because as Dr. Kennedy pointed out, and others have, if a virus material is in the cerebrospinal fluid, it's in the brain, because they are in direct connection. So the finding of the virus material in the CSF opens the pathway to considering possible mechanisms of injury in terms of the presence of some amount, some load of the virus material in the brain.
Let's talk about immune suppression also. It's mentioned in your report. It was an issue that you addressed, at least in Cedillo. I want to talk about it here. The argument is that Colton Snyder's immune system was likely suppressed at the time his MMR was given, and that created an inability of his body to clear the virus, and that was, in a sense, the part of the chain of events that led to persistence. Is that your understanding of the theory of this case?
Well, Dr. Kennedy explained that, and it seems totally reasonable. Prima facie, given the burst of infections that he had after receiving a vaccine that's known to be immune suppressive, that would be a reasonable thing to suppose.
And when you describe a possibility of immune suppression after the vaccination, what evidence are you referring to? Is this the medical record of his course of progress?
In Colton's case, the medical record was suddenly can't throw off his infections. Like any other child, he had infections before, and then they came and they went. But somehow, for some reason, they just kept on happening after the vaccination. It's not proof positive, but it's a reasonable probability. I might add that for me to make that suggestion doesn't mean that I'm of the opinion that clinical infection actually increases after giving the needles virus as a matter of course among the millions that receive it. I don't think the vaccine would be used if it were found that children got more and more infections after it. So I think that that cannot be the case in practice, but biology being what it is, it could surely be the case on rare occasions in certain children.
And would it be fair to say that the cluster of infections and the recurring infections that Colton Snyder experienced after he got the MMR is at the very least consistent with an immune suppressed system?
I think consistent is the correct word.
And you're also familiar with the testimony in the Cedillo matter of Dr. Beyer and Dr. Asposian, is that correct?
Yes.
And in that testimony in particular, they described the immune suppressive effect of thimerosal, of mercury, as contained in thimerosal. Do you recall the testimony in the reports? Now, you're not a toxicologist, correct?
I'm not.
And you're not an immunologist.
I'm not any of those people.
And those are the people that testified in Cedillo. So to the extent that you would identify or rely in your ultimate opinion on the notion that his immune system might have been suppressed when he got the shot, you would be relying on the evidence developed in Cedillo around Dr. Beyer and Dr. Asposian's testimony. Is that fair?
If I can rephrase that, I would say that relying on Dr. Baez, Dr. Aposhian, it would seem reasonable to think that maybe the child's immune system had been sensitized or in some way made vulnerable to the further effects of the immunosuppressive effect of the MMR.
Okay.
But as I say, this is an opinion relying on other experts.
Exactly. And so it's not an opinion that you would be stating to any degree of medical certainty, and you'd be relying on those other folks.
That's correct.
Okay. So we've talked in general terms, again, not hitting everything in your report, about the measles virus getting into the system, persisting in the system, the types of symptoms that are known to be caused by measles infections. We've talked about the measles virus then getting into the brain with the evidence through the CSF. I would like you to go ahead and talk a bit and at some level of detail about what you believe, in your expert opinion, happens when the measles virus gets into the brain and how it might be related to autism symptoms.
Right. One takes note in developing such a notion of what is known of the neuropathology in autistic individuals who've come to autopsy. And what is known is that there are abnormalities of the organization of the neurons in various parts, but are the limited evidence of actual loss of neurons. Certainly, what has not been reported is necrosis, which means ongoing dying neurons. What has been reported is a shortage of pyramidal cells in the cerebellum, and...
I'm sorry, what was that word, the type of cells?
Pyramidal.
You're pronouncing it properly, but I'm trying to make sure I understood the word. So
right.
The pyramid of cells in the brain.
Let me explain that properly.
Please.
There are several types of neurons in the brain. It's actually surprising that there are only a few different types. One of them is a large cell which has a pyramidal shape. It's really like a pyramid.
Okay, so it's three-sided, triangular.
So it really describes what it looks like under a microscope.
Okay.
And these are large cells which have axons that often go long distances, and there's a notable layer of a pyramidal layer in the cortex of the cerebellum. And looking there, one found those cells missing, as reported. Okay. But it's not really an attractive option to say that autism is caused by losing lots of neurons. That's not the case, as it may be in some other disorders. Rather, afterwards, it seems more attractive to develop a hypothesis which appeals to a combination of inflammation and the effects of inflammation on neurotransmitter function. And this is essentially the model that I describe in my article, in my report. And I hasten to say there, and I say again, I'm not arguing that I know that this is the case, and this is not an argument to a scientific level. I'm presenting it as a reasonable approach to suggesting such a mechanism. Now, the basis for making it attractive to assume that there is inflammation occurring in the brain is the well-known work by Vargas and colleagues from Hopkins, the group led by Dr. Pardo, and which includes Dr. Zimmerman, who has contributed importantly to it, who have in fact found inflammation in the brain. They found inflammation in two ways. They found it in autopsy specimens of people who unfortunately died while autistic for other reasons. And they have found neuroinflammation markers in the cerebrospinal fluid of other children, obviously living autistic children. And finding those inflammatory markers was interesting because what they found in the autopsy specimen in terms of inflammatory substances corresponded to what they found in these living children in the cerebrospinal fluid, and also corresponded to what Dr. Iannucci found in the blood of autistic children of regressive type in her investigation. So there's a database is building up of evidence of inflammation in autistic children and evidence that that inflammation involves the brain, can also obviously involve other parts such as the intestinal lining, but that's not my topic at this time. So using as a working model the idea that there is indeed neuroinflammation in Colton Snyder's brain, as was in quite a few of the children that were autopsied, not just one or two, by the Vargas group, one then notes the fact that this inflammation indicated the activity of what's called the innate immune system. The innate immune system being a generalized response to foreign bodies, invaders, as opposed to the adaptive immune system, which hones in on specific targets. The innate immune system is represented in the brain by glial cells, G-L-I-A-L cells, which are called microglia, and they are the counterpart of macrophages in the blood, in the general system of the body. And activation of the microglia causes the production of what are called pro-inflammatory cytokines. These are substances that cause inflammation, which was observed by the Vargas group. And
Dr. Kinsey, I just want to interrupt for a minute. When you say microglia, you're referring to the word M-I-C-R-O-G.
M-I-C-R-O.
So, okay, we might pronounce it micro, but it,
yes,
I'm thinking of the court reporter. I am not quarreling with your accent.
That's very humane, Special Master.
Okay.
I sometimes lapse into the English way of saying things. It's historical basis. While I'm on this topic, I should make the following distinction. Glial cells are the cells in the brain which are not the neurons. They have multiple other functions. They are supportive of the neurons in many ways. And there are three main categories. There are the astrocytes, star-shaped. There are the microglia. And also the oligodendrocytes, which are not relevant to my discussion. So, coming back then to how those are involved. The microglia then launch an attack on the apparent invader. Obviously, if they were to destroy the invader through the chemicals they release, there would be no further disease. That's not the case here. Sometimes they are able actually to destroy the cells within which the invader is hiding. It's called cytolysis. The cell breaks up. We don't have much evidence of that in what we know about the autistic brain. However, it also happens that the invader harbors safely within cells while the innate immune system keeps battering at it, keeps throwing out what one might call its friendly fire, which then, instead of eliminating the invader, damages the cells or the brain in the vicinity, such as, for example, the astrocytes. And there's also evidence of astrocytic activation and some evidence of the destruction of astrocytes based on the report of admittedly small amounts of what's called gliosis. Gliosis means scarring of caused by the death of glial cells.
And, excuse me, Dr. Kinsmore, what evidence would there be of astrocytes having died? Would that be the same evidence you'd see through the death of glial cells?
Well, it was reported by the Vargas groups that there was microglial and astrocytic activation.
Great. Right.
So I'm relying on that report.
Now, by activation, you're not saying dying, or are you?
No, activation, well, they begin to do what they are equipped to do but aren't necessarily doing. What happens in practice is that they produce chemicals, which they then release. As I already mentioned, that the microglia release pro-inflammatory cytokines, the astrocytes can actually release glutamate. And that's part of the picture that I'm presenting to the court.
Okay, so these are astrocytes, and the astrocytes release the glutamate because of the pro-inflammatory cytokine
yes.
action against them.
Exactly.
So they're attacked in friendly fire.
Exactly.
To use a military terminology, and then they react by releasing glutamate.
They do, right. And then at times, they actually die. Now I need to explain how the astrocytes relate to glutamate neurotransmission at glutamate synapses. I preface in that by stating, as I did in my report, that glutamate is the predominant excitatory neurotransmitter in the cerebrum, and perhaps in the brain in general. Now, glutamate is well known to be a substance that the brain needs to keep under tight control. So on the one hand it's very prevalent, and yet it must not exceed in its amount certain limits because it is known to be excitotoxic. In other words, it causes activation to a degree that the activated neuron can no longer sustain metabolically and that neuron dies. And this has been investigated in many other contexts, in the context of stroke, of neonatal brain damage, and so on. Now, there are several ways in which the amount of neurotransmitter released at the synapse is controlled. And one of these ways is that there are enzymes to break it down. Another way, an important one, is that some of it gets reabsorbed back into the neuron. That's done by what is called a transporter. So at glutamate synapses, you have, among other things, glutamate transporters that mop up the glutamate, which doesn't go straight to target. So it shouldn't spread outside the synapse and, as it were, bathe the network. It turns out that the astrocytes also have glutamate transporters. They pick up glutamate and then they recycle it back to the neuron that had secreted it in the first place. Now, the upshot of it in pathology is that if the astrocytes are wrapped around the synapse to do this job. If they die or malfunction or cease to do their transporting, then the amount of glutamate is out of control and the levels rise. And that's the bottom line of what happens when this mechanism goes awry. So, assuming that is the case, you now have a brain with more glutamate than is healthy for it, than it requires to keep it in appropriate activation-inhibition balance. So now I need to talk about this balance. Because the balance, because in the brain you tend not to have absolute levels of things, you have constantly have opponent processes, you have influences going in opposite ways, which then stabilize each other or change in a graded way. The excitation of glutamate in the brain is counteracted by the inhibition of a neurotransmitter called GABA. GA, it's in capitalized, it's an acronym, GABA. So the glutamate GABA ratio is the main determinant of the level of excitation or activation in the brain. And it varies within certain permissible parameters in normal brain function. If the glutamate levels rise out of control, then obviously the ratio is changed in direction of excess activation, and a number of consequences occur. The first and most obvious consequence is that there is overexcitation, which leads to a tendency to have seizures. And if not actual seizures, it leads to abnormal EEGs. And it is interesting and notable that sooner or later, about 30% of people with autism, in fact, have seizures, and that about 70% have abnormal EEGs short of having seizures. So an increase in the activation level due to excess glutamate is consistent, at least, with that fact. Obviously, it isn't the only possible explanation, but it is consistent. The second point that I can bring up now in terms of relating overactivation, presenting it as a feasible model of autistic behavior, is to say that a lot of autistic behavior can be described as stimulation avoiding. The people, they like not to be with crowds, they go out of control at birthday parties. You can't take a kid with autism to a birthday party. They will turn away, they'll avoid eye contact. The human face is very much, of course, a source of stimulation and unpredictability. They shun anything that's unpredictable. They don't like things to be changed. They behave as if they were trying to hold things constant, under control. They do not need stimulation. They react excessively to certain sounds and other stimuli. As a lot of the behavior seems like an attempt to keep stimulation no higher than it already is, given that it's already too high. And furthermore, that overstimulation is not just a neurological fact, it's also a subjective fact. It's what we experience subjectively when we are anxious, and particularly when we're in a state of panic. That is what it's like for the brain to be overstimulated. And I suggest that children with autism very much pull their attention inward. They remarkably ignore most of what's happening outside them, except when they absolutely have to pay attention to it, because of what's going on inside them subjectively. There is a phenomenon that has been known in cognitive psychology since 1959, actually, it was first described, which is to do with the effect of increasing activation levels on the focus of attention. And it was shown then, and it's been much confirmed, that as a person becomes more overactivated, over-aroused, anxious, their focus of attention becomes narrower and narrower and narrower, until finally they're just focusing on one thing. And an extreme example of this, a topical example, is what's called weapon focus, when the person, under such terror, is not even noticing who's holding the gun. And it is classical and otherwise perplexing why autistic children will notice not only just one object, but one part of an object, or one little component. They have this, as has been documented for many years, they have this tremendously focused down attention. And that is consistent with an overactivated system. One more major aspect of autistic behavior, actually there are so many more, but let me make one more point in principle. In the criteria for being autistic, we have the problem with language, a problem with social perception and behavior, and we have the abnormal movements, the stereotypes and mannerisms. Now, I have proposed, and I first wrote about this in an article in 1980, which was submitted in CEDEO, that the reason that the children go into their stereotypic routines is to decrease their arousal levels. And I cited quite a bit of animal evidence that analogous behaviors in animals are induced when animals are put into situations of conflict or thwarting, and they seem to be using this, not deliberately, but by some mechanism, to lower their arousal level. And it is quite consistent with the notion of overactivation in the autistic brain that from time to time they would go into routines that are otherwise inexplicable. But for some reason they do, and I believe it's in the sense, to put it simply, to calm themselves down.
And Dr. Kinsborn, what you're describing here in general terms, I'm assuming, are things that you would see in the presentation of Colton Snyder symptoms, is that correct?
You would, and he is recorded, although he's not an extreme case of this, he's recorded doing what people in the field call stimming, which are all this repetitive behavior of his.
And repetitive play behavior, for example,
yes, which
did you hear the testimony, yes, about repetitive play behavior with, yes, toys?
Yes, which was so vividly described, I see as using predictability to calm yourself down. And we'll not give more examples, but yes, that's correct.
And did you also find it significant in reaching the conclusions that you've reached in this case that from the testimony of his family and his caregivers that his play behavior changed from before and after the MMR? Does that affect your opinion in this case?
Oh, that is dramatic. That indeed is part of him becoming autistic, of course. But yes, why would autistic children line up things all the time? Or to say, oh, that's a feature of autism doesn't explain anything, and I'm attempting to produce an explanation which fits in with some information we know about people who know autistic people.
And then, so to pull some of these ideas together then, it would be your expert opinion to a reasonable degree of scientific probability that the measles virus that we've already described existing in Colton Snyder's brain, it would be your expert opinion that that persisting virus is the invader that you were describing that triggered the cascade of neurological processes.
Yes, sir.
And the persistent presence of the measles virus in the brain meant that those neurological processes would also be ongoing.
Yes.
And that the inflammation process and the disequilibrium between excitation and the inhibitory process, that is ongoing because of the persistence of the virus.
Yes.
And you see all of this as having not existed before he received his MMR and only existing after he received his MMR.
I saw nothing in the medical records or in testimony to suggest it existed before.
then these opinions are also supported by your expert opinion to a reasonable degree of scientific probability that the measles virus is both neurotropic and neurovirulent, correct?
Correct.
And that because of those two characteristics, when in the brain, they would be treated as a foreign body and would trigger the release of pro-inflammatory cytokines and the sequelae neurologically.
Correct.
And all of that you believe to a reasonable degree of scientific probability?
I do.
So in this case, given the testimony that you've heard and given in the Sedillo matter and in this matter, in the review of the medical literature, and in your experience and in your own research, can you say to a reasonable degree of scientific probability that a persistent measles virus via the MMR was a significant contributing cause of Colton Snyder's autistic symptoms?
Yes, I can. I do.
Right. I believe that's all that I have for direct.
I'm assuming you want to recess before we do cross-examination?
Yes, ma'am.
All right. How about we reconvene at 3 o'clock?
Thank you, ma'am. Thank you.